My old friend tried valiantly to detain us. I convinced him that our flight had not been undertaken lightly. As on a previous occasion, Dwarka refused my invitation to set forth to the Himalayas. While our train stood in a station that night, and I was half asleep, Amar was awakened by another questioning official. He, too, fell a victim to the hybrid charms of Thomas and Thompson. The train bore us triumphantly into a dawn arrival at Hardwar. The majestic mountains loomed invitingly in the distance. We dashed through the station and entered the freedom of city crowds. Our first act was to change into native costume, as Ananta had somehow penetrated our European disguise. A premonition of capture weighed on my mind. Deeming it advisable to leave Hardwar at once, we bought tickets to proceed north to Rishikesh, a soil long hallowed by flight toward the Himalayas, feet of many masters. I had already boarded the train, while Amar lagged on the platform. He was brought to an abrupt halt by a shout from a policeman. Our unwelcome guardian escorted us to a station bungalow and took charge of our money. He explained courteously that it was his duty to hold us until my elder brother arrived. Learning that the truant's destination had been the Himalayas, the officer related a strange story. "I see you are crazy about saints. You will never meet a greater man of God than the one I saw only yesterday. My brother officer and I first encountered him 5 days ago. We were patrolling by the Ganges, on a sharp lookout for a certain murderer. Our instructions were to capture him, alive or dead. He was known to be masquerading as a sadhu in order to rob pilgrims. A short way before us, we spied a figure which resembled the description of the criminal. He ignored our command to stop. We ran to overpower him. Approaching his back, I wielded my axe with tremendous force. The man's right arm was severed almost completely from his body. Without outcry or any glance at the ghastly wound, the stranger astonishingly continued his swift pace. As we jumped in front of him, he spoke quietly, "I am not the murderer you are seeking." I was deeply mortified to see I had injured the person of a divine-looking sage. Prostrating myself at his feet, I implored his pardon, and offered my turban cloth to staunch the heavy spurts of blood. "Son, that was just an understandable mistake on your part." The saint regarded me kindly. "Run along, and don't reproach yourself. The beloved mother is taking care of me." He pushed his dangling arm into its stump and lo, it adhered. The blood inexplicably ceased to flow. "Come to me under yonder tree in 3 days and you will find me fully healed. Thus you will feel no remorse. Yesterday my brother officer and I went eagerly to the designated spot. The sadhu was there and allowed us to examine his arm. It bore no scar or trace of hurt. I am going via Rishikesh to the Himalayan solitudes." He blessed us as he departed quickly. I feel that my life has been uplifted through his sanctity. The officer concluded with a pious ejaculation. His experience had obviously moved him beyond his usual depths. With an impressive gesture, he handed me a printed clipping about the miracle, in the usual garbled manner of the sensational type of newspaper, not missing, alas. Even in India, the reporter's version was slightly exaggerated. It indicated that the sadhu had been almost decapitated. Amar and I lamented that we had missed the great yogi who could forgive his persecutor in such a Christ-like way. India, materially poor for the last 2 centuries, yet has an inexhaustible fund of divine wealth. Spiritual skyscrapers may occasionally be encountered by the wayside, even by worldly men like this policeman. We thanked the officer for relieving our tedium with his marvelous story. He was probably intimating that he was more fortunate than we. He had met an illumined saint without effort. Our earnest search had ended, not at the feet of a master, but in a coarse police station. So near the Himalayas and yet, in our captivity, so far, I told Amar I felt doubly impelled to seek freedom. "Let us slip away when opportunity offers. We can go on foot to Holy Rishikesh." I smiled encouragingly. But my companion had turned pessimist as soon as the stalwart prop of our money had been taken from us. If we started a trek over such dangerous jungle land, We should finish, not in the city of saints, but in the stomachs of tigers. Anantu and Amar's brother arrived after 3 days. Amar greeted his relative with affectionate relief. I was unreconciled, Anantu got no more from me than a severe upbraiding. I understand how you feel. My brother spoke soothingly. All I ask of you is to accompany me to Benares to meet a certain saint, and go on to Calcutta to visit your grieving father for a few days. Then you can resume your search here for a master. Amar entered the conversation at this point to disclaim any intention of returning to hard war with me. He was, flight toward the Himalayas, enjoying the familial warmth. But I knew I would never abandon the quest for my guru. Our party entrained for Benares. There I had a singular and instant response to my prayers. A clever scheme had been pre-arranged by Ananta. Before seeing me at hard war, he had stopped in Benares to ask a certain scriptural authority to interview me later. Both the pundit and his son had promised to undertake my dissuasion from the path of a sannyasi. Ananta took me to their home. The son, a young man of ebullient manner, greeted me in the courtyard. He engaged me in a lengthy philosophic discourse. Professing to have a clairvoyant knowledge of my future, he discountenanced my idea of being a monk. You will meet continual misfortune, and be unable to find God, if you insist on deserting your ordinary responsibilities. You cannot work out your past karma away without worldly experiences. Krishna's immortal words rose to my lips in reply. Even he with the worst of karma who ceaselessly meditates on me quickly loses the effects of his past bad actions. Becoming a high-soul being, he soon attains perennial peace. Arjuna, know this for certain, the devotee who puts his trust in me never perishes. But the forceful prognostications of the young man had slightly shaken my confidence. With all the fervor of my heart I prayed silently to God, please solve my bewilderment and answer me, right here and now, if thou dost desire me to lead the life of a renunciate or a worldly man. I noticed a sadhu of noble countenance standing just outside the compound of the pundit's house. Evidently he had overheard the spirited conversation between the self-styled clairvoyant and myself, for the stranger called me to his side. I felt a tremendous power flowing from his calm eyes. Son, don't listen to that ignoramus. In response to your prayer, the Lord tells me to assure you that your sole path in this life is that of the renunciate. With astonishment as well as gratitude, I smiled happily at this decisive message. Come away from that man. The ignoramus was calling me from the courtyard. My saintly guide raised his hand in blessing and slowly departed. That sadhu is just as crazy as you are. It was the hoary-headed pundit who made this charming observation. He and his son were gazing at me lugubriously. I heard that he too has left his home in a vague search for God. I turned away. To Anantu I remarked that I would not engage in further discussion with our hosts. My brother agreed to an immediate departure. We soon entrained for Calcutta. Mr. Detective, how did you discover I had fled with 2 companions? I vented my lively curiosity to Anantu during our homeward journey. He smiled mischievously. At your school, I found that Amar had left his classroom and had not returned. I went to his home the next morning and unearthed a marked timetable. Amar's father was just leaving by carriage and was talking to the coachman. My son will not ride with me to his school this morning. He has disappeared. The father moaned. I heard from a brother coachman that your son and 2 others, dressed in European suits, boarded the train at Howrah station, the man stated. They made a present of their leather shoes to the cab driver. Thus I had 3 clues: the timetable, the trio of boys, and the English clothing. I was listening to Ananta's disclosures with mingled mirth and vexation. Our generosity to the coachman had been slightly misplaced. Of course I rushed to send telegrams to station officials in all the cities which Amar had underlined in the timetable. He had checked barely, so I wired your friend Walker there. After inquiries in our Calcutta neighborhood, I learned that cousin Jatinder had been absent one night but had arrived home the following morning in European garb. I sought him out and invited him to dinner. He accepted, quite disarmed by my friendly manner. On the way I led him unsuspectingly to a police station. He was surrounded by several officers whom I had previously selected for their ferocious appearance. Under their formidable gaze, Jatinder agreed to account for his mysterious conduct. I started for the Himalayas in a buoyant spiritual mood, he explained. Inspiration filled me at the prospect of meeting the masters. But as soon as Mukunda said, during our ecstasies in the Himalayan caves, tigers will be spellbound and sit around us like tame pussies, my spirits froze, beads of perspiration formed on my brow. What then? I thought. If the vicious nature of the tigers be not changed through the power of our spiritual trance, shall they treat us with the kindness of house cats? In my mind's eye, I already saw myself the compulsory inmate of some tiger's stomach entering there not at once with the whole body, but by installments of its several parts. My anger at Jatinder's vanishment was evaporated in laughter. The hilarious sequel on the train was worth all the anguish he had caused me. I must confess to a slight feeling of satisfaction, Jatinder too had not escaped an encounter with the police. Ananta, you are a born sleuthhound. My glance of amusement was not without some exasperation. And I shall tell Jatinder I am glad he was prompted by no mood of treachery, as it appeared, but only by the prudent instinct of self-preservation. At home in Calcutta, father touchingly requested me to curb my roving feet until, at least, the completion of my high school studies. In my absence, he had lovingly hatched a plot by arranging for a saintly pundit, Swami Kabalananda, to come regularly to the house. The sage will be your Sanskrit tutor, my parent announced confidently. Father hoped to satisfy my religious yearnings by instructions from a learned philosopher. But the tables were subtly turned. My new teacher, far from offering intellectual aridities, fanned the embers of my God aspiration. Unknown to father, Swami Kabalananda was an exalted disciple of Lahiri Mahasaya. The peerless guru had possessed thousands of disciples, silently drawn to him by the irresistibility of his divine magnetism. I learned later that Lahiri Mahasaya had often characterized Kabalananda as rishi or illumined sage. Luxuriant curls framed my tutor's handsome face. His dark eyes were guileless, with the transparency of a child's. All the movements of his slight body were marked by a restful deliberation. Ever gentle and loving, he was firmly established in the infinite consciousness. Many of our happy hours together were spent in deep kriya meditation. Kabalananda was a noted authority on the ancient shastras or sacred books. His erudition had earned him the title of Shastri Mahasaya, by which he was usually addressed. But my progress in Sanskrit scholarship was unnoteworthy. I sought every opportunity to forsake prosaic grammar and to talk of yoga and Lahiri Mahasaya. My tutor obliged me one day by telling me something of his own life with the master. Rarely fortunate, I was able to remain near Lahiri Mahasaya for 10 years. His Benares home was my nightly goal of pilgrimage. The guru was always present in a small front parlor on the first floor. As he sat in lotus posture on a backless wooden seat, his disciples garlanded him in a semicircle. His eyes sparkled and danced with the joy of the divine. They were ever half closed, peering through the inner telescopic orb into a sphere of eternal bliss. He seldom spoke at length. Occasionally his gaze would focus on a student in need of help, healing words poured then like an avalanche of light. An indescribable peace blossomed within me at the master's glance. I was permeated with his fragrance, as though from a lotus of infinity. To be with him, even without exchanging a word for days, was experience which changed my entire being. If any invisible barrier rose in the path of my concentration, I would meditate at the guru's feet. There the most tenuous states came easily within my grasp. Such perceptions eluded me in the presence of lesser teachers. The master was a living temple of God whose secret doors were open to all disciples through devotion. Lahiri Mahasaya was no bookish interpreter of the scriptures. Effortlessly he dipped into the divine library. Foam of words and spray of thoughts gushed from the fountain of his omniscience. He had the wondrous clavis which unlocked the profound philosophical science embedded ages ago in the Vedas. If asked to explain the different planes of consciousness mentioned in the ancient texts, he would smilingly assent. I will undergo those states, and presently tell you what I perceive. He was thus diametrically unlike the teachers who commit scripture to memory and then give forth unrealized abstractions. Please expound the holy stanzas as the meaning occurs to you. The taciturn guru often gave this instruction to a nearby disciple. I will guide your thoughts, that the right interpretation be uttered. In this way many of Lahiri Mahasaya's perceptions came to be recorded, with voluminous commentaries by various students. The master never counseled slavish belief. Words are only shells, he said. Win conviction of God's presence through your own joyous contact in meditation. No matter what the disciple's problem, the guru advised Kriya Yoga for its solution. The yogic key will not lose its efficiency when I am no longer present in the body to guide you. This technique cannot be bound, filed, and forgotten, in the manner of theoretical inspirations. Continue ceaselessly on your path to liberation through Kriya, whose power lies in practice. I myself consider Kriya the most effective device of salvation through self-effort ever to be evolved in man's search for the infinite. Kabbalananda concluded with this earnest testimony. Through its use, the omnipotent God, hidden in all men, became visibly incarnated in the flesh of Lahiri Mahasaya and a number of his disciples. A Christ-like miracle by Lahiri Mahasaya took place in Kabbalananda's presence. My saintly tutor recounted the story one day, his eyes remote from the Sanskrit texts before us. A blind disciple, Ramu, aroused my active pity. Should he have no light in his eyes, when he faithfully served our master, in whom the divine was fully blazing? One morning I sought to speak to Ramu, but he sat for patient hours fanning the guru with a handmade palm leaf apunkya. When the devotee finally left the room, I followed him. Ramu, how long have you been blind?
From my birth, sir. Never have my eyes been blessed with a glimpse of the sun.
Our omnipotent guru can help you. Please make a supplication. The following day Ramu diffidently approached Lahiri Mahasaya. The disciple felt almost ashamed to ask that physical wealth be added to his spiritual superabundance. Master, the illuminator of the cosmos is in you. I pray you to bring his light into my eyes, that I perceived the sun's lesser glow. Ramu, someone has connived to put me in a difficult position. I have no healing power.
Sir, the infinite one within you can certainly heal.
That is indeed different, Ramu. God's limit is nowhere. He who ignites the stars and the cells of flesh with mysterious life effulgence can surely bring luster of vision into your eyes. The master touched Ramu's forehead at the point between the eyebrows. Keep your mind concentrated there, and frequently chant the name of the prophet Rama for 7 days. The splendor of the sun shall have a special dawn for you. Lo! In 1 week it was so. For the first time, Ramu beheld the fair face of nature. The omniscient one had unerringly directed his disciple to repeat the name of Rama, adored by him above all other saints. Ramu's faith was the devotionally plowed soil in which the guru's powerful seed of permanent healing sprouted. Kabbalananda was silent for a moment, then paid a further tribute to his guru. It was evident in all miracles performed by Lahiri Mahasaya that he never allowed the ego principle to consider itself a causative force. By perfection of resistless surrender, the master enabled the prime healing power to flow freely through him. The numerous bodies which were spectacularly healed through Lahiri Mahasaya eventually had to feed the flames of cremation. But the silent spiritual awakenings he effected, the Christ-like disciples he fashioned, are his imperishable miracles. I never became a Sanskrit scholar, Kabbalananda taught me a diviner syntax. Chapter 5. I did not have this wisdom of Solomon to comfort me, I gazed searchingly about me, on any excursion from home, for the face of my destined guru. But my path did not cross his own until after the completion of my high school studies. 2 years elapsed between my flight with Amar toward the Himalayas, and the great day of Sri Yukteswar's arrival into my life.
During that interim I met a number of sages, the Perfume Saint, the Tiger Swami, Nagendranath Baduri, Master Mahasaya, and the famous Bengali scientist, Jagadish Chandra Bose. My encounter with the Perfume Saint had two preambles, one harmonious and the other humorous. God is simple, everything else is complex. Do not seek absolute values in the relative world of nature. These philosophical finalities gently entered my ear as I stood silently before a temple image of Kali. Turning, I confronted a tall man whose garb, or lack of it, revealed him a wandering sadhu. "You have indeed penetrated the bewilderment of my thoughts," I smiled gratefully. "The confusion of benign and terrible aspects in nature, as symbolized by Kali, has puzzled wiser heads than mine. Few there be who solve her mystery. Good and evil is the challenging riddle which life places sphinx-like before every intelligence. Attempting no solution, most men pay forfeit with their lives, penalty now even as in the days of Thebes. Here and there, a towering lonely figure never cries defeat. From the mire of duality he plucks the cleaveless truth of unity. You speak with conviction, sir. I have long exercised an honest introspection, the exquisitely painful approach to wisdom. Self-scrutiny, relentless observance of one's thoughts, is a stark and shattering experience. It pulverizes the stoutest ego. But true self-analysis mathematically operates to produce seers. The way of self-expression, individual acknowledgements, results in egotists, sure of the right to their private interpretations of God and the universe. Truth humbly retires, no doubt, before such arrogant originality. I was enjoying the discussion. Man can understand no eternal verity until he has freed himself from pretensions. The human mind, bared to a centuried slime, is teeming with repulsive life of countless world delusions. Struggles of the battlefields pale into insignificance here, when man first contends with inward enemies. No mortal foes these, to be overcome by harrowing array of might. Omnipresent, unresting, pursuing man even in sleep, subtly equipped with a miasmic weapon, these soldiers of ignorant lusts seek to slay us all. Thoughtless is the man who buries his ideals, surrendering to the common fate. Can he seem other than impotent, wooden, ignominious? Respected sir, have you no sympathy for the bewildered masses? The sage was silent for a moment, then answered obliquely. To love both the invisible God, repository of all virtues, and visible man, apparently possessed of none, is often baffling. But ingenuity is equal to the maze. Inner research soon exposes a unity in all human minds, the stalwart kinship of selfish motive. In one sense at least, the brotherhood of man stands revealed. An aghast humility follows this leveling discovery. It ripens into compassion for one's fellows, blind to the healing potencies of the soul awaiting exploration. The saints of every age, sir, have felt like yourself for the sorrows of the world. Only the shallow man loses responsiveness to the woes of others' lives, as he sinks into narrow suffering of his own. The sadhu's austere face was noticeably softened. The one who practices a scalpel self-dissection will know an expansion of universal pity. Release is given him from the deafening demands of his ego. The love of God flowers on such soil. The creature finally turns to his creator, if for no other reason than to ask in anguish, "Why, Lord, why?" By ignoble whips of pain, man is driven at last into the infinite presence, whose beauty alone should lure him. The sage and I were present in Calcutta's Kaliyat temple, whither I had gone to view its famed magnificence. With a sweeping gesture, my chance companion dismissed the ornate dignity. Bricks and mortar sing us no audible tune. The heart opens only to the human chant of being. We strolled to the inviting sunshine at the entrance, where throngs of devotees were passing to and fro. "You are young?" the sage surveyed me thoughtfully. "Indy too is young." The ancient rishis laid down ineradicable patterns of spiritual living. The rishis, literally seers, were the authors of the Vedas in an indeterminable antiquity. Their hoary dictums suffice for this day and land. Not outmoded, not unsophisticated against the guiles of materialism, the disciplinary precepts mold India still. By millenniums more than embarrassed scholars care to compute! The skeptic time has validated Vedic worth. Take it for your heritage. As I was reverently bidding farewell to the eloquent sadhu, he revealed a clairvoyant perception. After you leave here today, an unusual experience will come your way. I quitted the temple precincts and wandered along aimlessly. Turning a corner, I ran into an old acquaintance, one of those long-winded fellows whose conversational powers ignore time and embrace eternity. I will let you go in a very short while, if you will tell me all that has happened during the 6 years of our separation. What a paradox. I must leave you now. But he held me by the hand, forcing out tidbits of information. He was like a ravenous wolf, I thought in amusement. The longer I spoke, the more hungrily he sniffed for news. Inwardly I petitioned the goddess Kali to devise a graceful means of escape. My companion left me abruptly. I sighed with relief and doubled my pace, dreading any relapse into the garrulous fever. Hearing rapid footsteps behind me, I quickened my speed. I dared not look back. But with a bound, the youth rejoined me, jovially clasping my shoulder. I forgot to tell you of Gandhababa, perfume saint, who is gracing yonder house. He pointed to a dwelling a few yards distant. Do meet him, he is interesting. You may have an unusual experience. Goodbye. And he actually left me. The similarly worded prediction of the sadhu at Kaliyat temple flashed to my mind. Definitely intrigued, I entered the house and was ushered into a commodious parlor. A crowd of people were sitting, orient-wise, here and there on a thick orange-colored carpet. An awed whisper reached my ear, "Behold Gandhababa on the leopard skin. He can give the natural perfume of any flower to a scentless one, or revive a wilted blossom, or make a person's skin exude delightful fragrance." I looked directly at the saint, his quick gaze rested on mine. He was plump and bearded, with dark skin and large, the perfume saint, gleaming eyes. "Son, I am glad to see you. Say what you want. Would you like some perfume?" "What for?" I thought his remark rather childish. "To experience the miraculous way of enjoying perfumes. Harnessing God to make odors? What of it? God makes perfume anyway." "Yes, but he fashions frail bottles of petals for fresh use and discard. Can you materialize flowers?" "I materialize perfumes, little friend. Then scent factories will go out of business. I will permit them to keep their trade. My own purpose is to demonstrate the power of God." "Sir, is it necessary to prove God? Isn't he performing miracles in everything, everywhere?" "Yes. But we too should manifest some of his infinite creative variety. How long did it take to master your art?"
12 years.
"For manufacturing scents by astral means. It seems, my honored saint, you have been wasting a dozen years for fragrances which you can obtain with a few rupees from a florist's shop. Perfumes fade with flowers. Perfumes fade with death. Why should I desire that which pleases the body only? Mr. Philosopher, you please my mind. Now, stretch forth your right hand." He made a gesture of blessing. I was a few feet away from Gandhababa, no one else was near enough to contact my body. I extended my hand, which the yogi did not touch. "What perfume do you want?"
"Rose."
"Be it so." To my great surprise, the charming fragrance of rose was wafted strongly from the center of my palm. I smilingly took a large white scentless flower from a nearby vase. "Can this odorless blossom be permeated with jasmine?"
"Be it so."
A jasmine fragrance instantly shot from the petals. Thanked the wonder worker and seated myself by one of his students. He informed me that Gandhababa, whose proper name was Vishudananda, had learned many astonishing yoga secrets from a master in Tibet. The Tibetan yogi, I was assured, had attained the age of over 1,000 years. His disciple Gandhababa does not always perform his perfume feats in the simple verbal manner you have just witnessed. The student spoke with obvious pride in his master. His procedure differs widely, to accord with diversity in temperaments. He is marvelous. Many members of the Calcutta intelligentsia are among his followers. I inwardly resolved not to add myself to their number,